Angus Ebersole, Clay Hawkins, Ike Peters, and Jim Dewey rode hard for the first mile. Then they stopped atop a hill and looked back down at the track as the passengers and train crew worked to clear it. Hawkins looked hard at Ebersole.
I thought you said this would be easy.
I didn't say it would be easy. I said it would pay off well. That train is carrying army payrolls of 3/4. That's a lot of money there.
Yeah, that's the thing. The money is there. It ain't here.
How was I to know that Falcon McAllister and Buffalo Bill would both be on that train? There just ain't no way of finding out about stuff like that.
Jim Dewey shook his head.
You think that was really them?
You seen how easy they cut down Smitty, Hunt, and Collins, didn't you? Yeah, I think it was really them.
I didn't know they was real.
What do you mean you didn't think they was real, Peters? You seen them, didn't you?
Yeah, I seen them, but like I said, I didn't think there was really any such people. I thought they was like Santa Claus. I thought they was just something somebody made up to tell stories about.
Yeah, they're real, all right.
What if we was to go back down there now, catch them while they're working to clear the track? We might be able to surprise them.
The rest of us might get killed, too.
Damn. I about had that money spent.
I reckon old Billy Taylor won't be having himself none of them Mexican gals.
Won't none of us be doing nothing.
Let's get out of here.
It was mid-morning when the train rolled into Bismarck, Dakota Territory, where it was met by Mr. I.W. Emmons, the station agent. Told of the attempted robbery, the station agent summoned Sheriff Walter Merrill, who took the prisoner into custody. Within 15 minutes of the arrival of the train, the entire town knew of the attempted train robbery. They also knew that Falcon McAllister and Buffalo Bill Cody, two of the nation's most storied Western personalities, foiled the attempt. That same morning, Prentice Ingram presented himself to Marshal Jewell, editor of the Bismarck Tribune. The Tribune had been started by C.A. Lounsbury and was made famous by its coverage of Custer's last fight at the Little Bighorn. But Lounsbury sold the paper in 1884 during his unsuccessful bid to be governor of the territory. Ingram sold Jewell on the idea of a first-person account of the foiled train robbery, told by the famed author of so many dime novels. He composed the story quickly then and there, writing it with large and easily read strokes of the pen. When Ingram rejoined Falcon and Cody, he was wearing a pistol, explaining that he may as well dress the part if he were going to be involved in the excitement, and citing his experience in enough wars to be proficient with a gun. Falcon had last passed through Fort Lincoln in July 1876, having returned to the fort with what remained of the 7th Cavalry after the disastrous fight at Little Bighorn. Because the 7th had moved to Fort Meade, Dakota Territory, none of them remained at Fort Lincoln. Nevertheless, memories of the post, the events, and the people of Fort Lincoln swirled through Falcon's mind. But it wasn't for nostalgia alone that Falcon was visiting. Colonel Sturgis, currently the commanding officer at Fort Lincoln, would be an ideal person to talk to regarding the spirit-talking movement. And it was for that reason they had come.
Lieutenant, I am Colonel William Cody. This is Colonel Falcon McAllister, and we would like to speak to your commander.
You are colonels?
I told you that we were.
I'm sorry, sir, but you aren't in uniform, and I can't just let anyone in to see the commander.
Perhaps this will help.
Falcon produced the letter of commission given him by General Miles. The lieutenant looked at the letter for a moment, then stood quickly and saluted sharply.
I beg your pardon, sir. Please forgive me for my behavior.
There's nothing to forgive, Lieutenant. You're just doing your job. Would that I had an adjutant as dedicated to protecting me from unwanted visitors.
Wait here, sir. I'll be but a moment.
The lieutenant went into the commandant's office, but he left the door open, and though neither Falcon nor Cody could hear what he said to Colonel Sturgis, they certainly heard Sturgis's reply.
What? Falcon McAllister and Buffalo Bill Cody are both in my office? And you left them cooling their heels outside? Show them in! Show them in at once! No, wait. I'll do it myself!
Colonel Sturgis emerged from his office with a broad smile and an extended hand. He greeted Falcon and Buffalo Bill.
Ha ha! You're here just in time for lunch. Please, be my guests.
The Colonel was not just whistling Dixie. Mrs. Sturgis went all out in preparing the lunch, complete with chicken consomme, roast beef, roast potatoes, lima beans, and an apple pie for dessert.
Now, gentlemen, what brings you here?
I need you ask. We've traveled 2,000 miles for this delightful lunch, and it was worth every mile.
Cody smiled at Mrs. Sturgis.
Well, of course. But there is another reason, is there not?
Yes. Colonel, have you ever heard of something called spirit talking?
Yes, spirit talking. The Indians call it Waji-Wanaji.
Do you think it is likely to cause another Indian war?
Sturgis stroked his jaw for a moment as he looked back at Falcon and Cody.
Why do you ask that? Have you heard something that I have not?
We can't answer that until we know what you've heard.
Well, I know that it has made the Indians a bit more assertive, if not aggressive.
What do you know of this spirit talking?
The best way to describe it would be to call it a religion, though it is an unholy religion at best. It was started by Mean to his horses, who was with Crazy Horse during the Battle of Little Bighorn. But he was such an unknown then that nobody had ever heard of him. Now he has a movement following him, and the movement has cut across the nations. Not just the Cheyenne, but all the Sioux nations, and even some Indian tribes beyond the Sioux. I've heard as many as 200 warriors follow him. Another 200 women, children, and elders round out his movement at last count, though I understand it's still growing. From what some of the Indians have told me, this spirit talking is a way of talking to the souls of Indians that have already died. The dead know everything, including the future. And the dead have told them that all the white men will soon be leaving. When that happens, the buffalo will come back and the land will return to the Indians.
So, I will ask again, do you think this portends war?
General Miles thinks that, doesn't he?
He thinks it is possible, and he thinks that Sitting Bull is behind it.
As to whether or not this could lead to war, I can't answer. As I said, it has made the Indians more assertive. But I believe I can answer as to whether or not Sitting Bull is behind it.
And what would that answer be? Do you think Sitting Bull is behind it?
Absolutely not.
Nearly 100 miles away, Ponyface and Red Shield, two Crow hunters, looked for elk in the open range near the Meteetse River. They were off the Crow Reservation, but they had no cause for worry. They had a long record of peaceful coexistence with the white man. Now, one band of Crow, under Chief High Hawk, lived on a reservation set aside for him just outside the eastern entrance to Yellowstone Park. And though they had a specific part of the valley set aside for their use, it was understood that they could hunt anywhere in the valley they wished. In addition, many of the Crow had made friends with farmers and ranchers in the area, often trading with them, sometimes stopping by to visit while on a hunt to take a meal with them and to leave game for them. Because of that friendly relationship, when Ponyface and Red Shield saw a couple of white men approaching them, they weren't concerned. Perhaps they were part of the Sign of Peace, a group of white men looking for gold. The hunters approached the white men.
We are Crow.
Ponyface held his hand up, palm out, to show that he was friendly.
We are friends.
To the surprise of the two Crow hunters, the white men pointed their guns at him.
We've had enough of you Injuns attacking our homes and killing our women and children.
You speak of Cheyenne. We are not Cheyenne, we are Crow.
No, you're Injuns.
Sam Davis and Lee Regret looked at the two bodies, holding their still smoking guns.
Think there are any more around here?
We haven't seen any more.
What do we do now?
Let's get out of here. I don't think there's any more of them around. But there's no need to hang around, just in case.
day after the shooting, Gray Antelope and Howling Wolf found the two hunters. And when they brought the bodies back into the camp, the entire village turned out to grieve. Both Ponyface and Red Shield had wives and children. High Hawk, the tribal chief, called a council to discuss the killing of the two hunters.
We should kill two whites.
The whites already think we have killed two of them, White Bull. Two of the men who hunt for gold were found dead and scalped.
It was not an Indian who scalped them, Running Elk. What say you, High Hawk?
I think they were killed by other white men who hunt for gold, but the white men think they were killed by Crow.
And I think that Ponyface and Red Shield were also killed by men who hunt for gold.
Running Elk, you speak the white man's tongue. I think you should go to the white man's town and tell them that we've found two of our people killed and ask if they will find and punish the ones who did this thing.
I will go.
Angus Ebersole, Clay Hawkins, Ike Peters, and Jim Dewey were at a table at the back of Fireman's Exchange Saloon in Bismarck. Ebersole was the biggest of the four men, and though no vote had ever been taken, he was the leader of the group simply because he had assumed leadership. Ebersole was bald, but he had a dark handlebar mustache. Hawkins was thin and wiry with a flat nose. Peters and Dewey were medium-sized with unremarkable features. Ebersole folded the Tribune and put it on the table in front of him. He had been reading the article Ingram wrote about the would-be train holdup.
Falcon McAllister and Buffalo Bill Cody, sons of bitches. We'd have money now if it wasn't for them.
Yeah, I'm so broke I don't have two coins to rub together.
Falcon McAllister and Buffalo Bill. Who would have thought that two men would shoot down Smitty, Hunt, and Collins? Oh, and Billy!
Peters, they didn't kill Billy. Fact is, they got him in jail right here in town.
Dewey's right. And we need to get him out of jail.
Get him out? Get him out how?
Break him out, Hawkins.
Yeah, I reckon we do owe it to him, seeing as we run off and left him.
Owing it to him ain't got nothing at all to do with why I'm wanting to break him out.
Well then, if you don't think we owe it to him, why are you wanting to break him out?
He was with McAllister and Cody all the time from where they got him till they come here. I think he probably knows where they're going.
Why do we care where they're going?
Because soon as we find out where they're going, we're going to track them down and kill them.
Why?
Boys, you got any idea how famous we'll be if we do that? There won't be a person in this country who ain't heard of us.
That's why you want to kill him? So we'll be famous? I always sort of thought that in our line of work, we didn't exactly want to be famous.
It depends on what line of work you are talking about.
I don't have no idea in hell what you're talking about.
There's folks all over the country that needs jobs, special jobs done. And if we kill both McAllister and Cody, we'll be known as the kinds of people who can do those special jobs. We'll be able to hire out our guns and we'll make a ton of money from it.
Yeah, I guess you got a point there. It ain't something I've ever thought about, though.
How are we going to break him out?
Well, Hawkins, we'll do it tonight when the town is real quiet. Like as not, they won't have no more than one man a-watching over things at the jail. We'll just go in and force him to let Billy go.
When he was but 15 years old, Frank Barlow joined the army to save the Union. Captured at Kennesaw Mountain, he was one of the youngest prisoners of war in the Confederate prisoner of war camp at Andersonville, Georgia. He spent just under a year in the prison, where over 13,000 died. Emerging from his incarceration weighing only 94 pounds. When he went back to Indiana, he worked on his pa's farm until learning of land to be had simply by homesteading out west, he got married and moved to Wyoming territory. It was a gamble, and both his family and his new bride's family had tried to talk him out of it, but he was adamant, and his wife Ann backed him in his resolve. Now the gamble seemed to have paid off. Frank owned a small but successful ranch in Bighorn Basin in Yellowstone Valley. Last year, he had not only managed to support his family, he had actually turned a profit and he was already thinking about taking on a few hands to help him run the place. His son Davy, who was 8 years old, had just celebrated his birthday, and yesterday he and Ann threw a little party for him. Soon, Davy would be old enough to become a full partner in the operation of the ranch. Frank pumped water into the basin, worked up lather from a bar of lye soap, then washed his hands and face. Cold well water was bracing, and he reached for a towel and began drying off, thinking about the chicken and dumplings Ann cooked for their supper. He had worked hard today, and the enticing aroma was already causing his stomach to growl. Barlow had the towel over his face when he thought he felt a presence. Dropping the towel, he was surprised to see two mounted men looking down at him. He had neither seen nor heard them before this moment.
Name's Barlow, isn't it?
Yes. Not no more it ain't. Now, it ain't nothing.
What?
Let's just have us a little look-see around.
The U.S. Army first established a post at Fort Yates Indian Reservation in 1863 as the Standing Rock Cantonment, with the purpose of overseeing the Hunkpapa and Blackfoot bands. Though many still referred to it as Standing Rock, its name changed in 1878 to honor Captain George Yates, killed at the Battle of Little Bighorn in 1876. Falcon, Cody, and Ingram traveled to Fort Yates to meet with Sitting Bull. After the defeat of Custer, public reaction demanded revenge against the Indians, and over the next year, thousands of additional military arrived in the area. There, they relentlessly pursued the tribes who participated in the battle, the Lakota, Cheyenne, and Arapaho. But the Indians were no longer massed as they had been during the battle. Once the Indian nation separated, they were unable to withstand the military pressure brought against them, and the military subdued them rather quickly. The other Indian leaders surrendered, but Sitting Bull didn't. And in May of 1877, Sitting Bull led his band of Lakota across the border into Canada. When General Terry traveled north to offer him a pardon in exchange for settling on a reservation, Sitting Bull sent him away. Sitting Bull could not continue in Canada, though. Unlike the United States, Canada provided no beef or provisions of any kind. And with the buffalo nearly extinct, Sitting Bull couldn't feed his people. He had no option remaining except to head south to surrender. This he did on July 19th, 1881, whereupon he was sent to Fort Yates. In 1885, Sitting Bull received permission to leave the reservation to join Buffalo Bill's Wild West exhibition. However, he felt uncomfortable in white society, and he left the show after only 4 months. During that time, though, he did shake hands with President Grover Cleveland, which in his mind meant that he was still regarded as an important leader of the Sioux. James Laughlin, Indian agent at Fort Yates, now eyed Cody and McAllister.
Why do you wish to see Sitting Bull?
Because General Miles asked us to.
You can understand why I ask, I'm sure. People from all over come here to see Sitting Bull. Senators, congressmen, cabinet members, even foreign royalty.
Yes, he wasn't with my show for very long, but he was immensely popular while he was there.
It's not good for him to be so uppity. He has the idea that he still is a chief, and the other Indians on the reservation look up to him, even though he can do nothing for them. I am the one in charge. Sitting Bull can do nothing.
That isn't quite right.
What do you mean, it isn't quite right?
Sitting Bull can give them dignity.
Dignity? You want to see dignity?
McLaughlin pointed toward a large garden wherein potatoes, cabbage, cauliflower, eggplant, celery, peppers, cucumbers, and tomatoes grew. They could see several people working in the garden, all women, except for one man who, bent at the waist, worked with a hoe.
There's Sitting Bull. How's that for dignity?
Why are you doing that? Why are you subjecting Sitting Bull to such ignominy?
Who are you?
My name, sir, is Prentice Ingram. I am a writer.
A writer? You aren't part of General Miles's delegation.
He is with us. That makes him part of General Miles's delegation.
I have heard that you are a vain man, Cody.
That is Colonel Cody to you, Major.
Colonel Cody. But I had no idea that you were so vain as to have with you your own member of the press.
He will not only write about me, Major. He will also write about you. Though subtle, the implied threat hit home, and McLaughlin blinked as he understood the circumstances.
I see. Well, all right, Colonel Cody, what do you want?
I told you we want to speak with Sitting Bull.
Very well. I will summon him.
Major McLaughlin, do you have a reception room of some sort, a room where visiting dignitaries such as congressmen and senators are welcome as guests?
Yes, I have such a room.
Falcon pointed to Cody.
Buffalo Bill Cody is the most famous man in America, if not the world. He's been the guest of kings and queens for the world over. Now he is the guest of Sitting Bull. Please show us to the reception room.
Just a minute. Are you telling me you want me to bring Sitting Bull to the reception room?
Oh, I don't just want it. I expect it.
And you might have your cook make some lemonade. Working in the garden as he is, I expect Sitting Bull is thirsty. I also remember from his time with me that he has a fondness for sweets, and I'm sure your cook can accommodate us with some sort of treat.
Look here. I'm in charge here. I'll not be taking orders from visitors.
You'll take orders from these visitors.
I'll bring him to you.
The reception room was quite nice and, under the circumstances, quite well furnished with sofa and chairs. Heads of game peered from the walls and a huge buffalo skin lay on the floor. A few minutes after they went into the room, two Indian women came into the room, one of them carrying a large carafe of lemonade and the other a platter of cookies. Cody walked over to take one of the cookies. Well, they must have already had some baked. They couldn't have made a new batch this fast. Would you like one, Ingram?
No, thank you.
Ingram sat off to one side, writing furiously on his tablet. It was at least half an hour before McLaughlin returned with Sitting Bull.
In there.
McLaughlin turned to the others.
Sorry it took so long, but he insisted upon changing clothes before he met with you.
Oh, we don't mind the wait. Sitting Bull's face was expressionless until after McLaughlin left. Then, with a smile, he extended his hand to Cody.
Oh, Cody, it is a good day to see you again.
Hello, Sitting Bull, you old war horse. It's a good day to see you as well. This is my friend Falcon McAllister.
You were with Custer.
Yes.
That is past.
Sitting Bull offered his hand to Falcon.
Now we can be friends.
Sitting Bull looked over at Ingram, and though he said nothing, the expression on his face asked the question for him. This is Prentice Ingram. He's a writer.
You mean he does paper words?
Yes. How are you doing, Sitting Bull?
I have food and shelter. My wife's four robes, and seen by the nation, have food and shelter and do not complain.
I see McLaughlin has you working in the field. That is not right for a chief like you.
If it is right for my people to work in the field, then it is right for me as well.
But can you keep their respect?
Does not matter. They will kill me anyway.
Who will kill you?
My people will kill me. In a vision, I saw a meadowlark land beside me. I approached him, and I was surprised when he did not fly away. Why do you not fly away? I asked the bird. Do you not fear me? The bird answered me, your own people, the Lakota, will kill you. And because I heard this with my own ears, this I believe.
Your people love you. They will not kill you.
Was there not a great chief of the whites, loved by all, who was killed by a white man?
You're talking about Abraham Lincoln.
Yes. Was he killed by an Indian?
No, he was killed by John Wilkes Booth, a white man.
One of his people?
Not exactly. Booth was a Southern sympathizer.
One of his people?
Well, if you put it that way, yes.
I, too, will be killed by my own people.
I am truly sorry to hear this.
Such is the way of things.
Sitting Bull, what do you know of the Wajiwanaji?
Wajiwanaji? You wish to know of Wajiwanaji? You have come to the wrong person. Wajiwanaji is a religion started by Mean to His Horses.
Do you follow this religion of spirit talking?
Many have heard, and some believe. Many do not believe.
Now that is not what I asked, Sitting Bull. Do you follow this religion?
I do not follow this religion, but I have honor for this religion. I do not follow the Jesus religion of the white man, but also I have honor for that religion.
Do you think it will be a danger to the white man? Do you think it will start a war?
I think it will be a danger only to the Indian. For it is a religion that says the white man will leave and all the land will be returned to the people.
You don't believe that, do you?
I do not believe that. But my people do not understand. They think the only white people are those that they see. The soldiers, the Indian agents, the ranchers, farmers, and those in the towns. They have not seen what I have seen. They do not know what I know. I know how large is the village of the white man. I know that on the train, going much faster than the swiftest horse, it takes many days to cross the white man's land. I have seen, gathered to see one show, more white people than there are in all the nations of the Sioux. Another war can only mean the end of my people.
Will you do all that you can to prevent another war? Sitting Bull raised his hand to point to the garden.
I can tell the women who work in the garden with me that there should not be another war. But the women do not want war anyway. I can tell the old men who come to gather their rations that there should not be another war. But they are old, and they have seen war and do not want to see another. I can tell the young men that there should not be another war, but in many, their blood is hot with anger and distrust for the white man. So I do not think they will listen to me.
After his meeting with Sitting Bull, Cody went to the Army Signal Center, where he composed a telegram to be sent to General Miles. As per your instructions, I have interviewed Sitting Bull. It is my belief that he has no connection with the spirit-talking movement. The one behind the movement is Mean to His Horses, a Cheyenne. I believe that if there is to be any Indian trouble, it will come from a mixed bag of renegades, not a coordinated war launched by any particular tribe. After sending the telegram, Cody, Falcon, and Ingram took their lunch at the officers' open mess at Fort Yates. I thank you for coming with me, Falcon.
I didn't mind. As I said, I was coming back home anyway.
And before you return to Colorado, I wondered if you would like to stay with me a little longer. You may find the next part of the trip very interesting.
What do you have in mind?
First, I'm going to Damaris Springs, Wyoming Territory, the site where my town is to be. Very close to there. I thought I might look it over and show it to you and Ingram. From there, we will take a turn through Yellowstone Park. Have you ever been there?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, there are some fascinating things to see there. Then, from Yellowstone, I am going up to Cinnabar, where I will be holding an audition.
An audition?
Yes, I'll be looking for new cowboys. Where do you think I get the people for my exhibition?
Well, I don't know. I guess I've never really thought about it.
Well, I think about it all the time. I have to think about it. And believe me, I can't get cowboys from Brooklyn. They have to be authentic, or the people who come to my shows will see it in a second. And to be honest, I would like to have you help me pick out the ones I can use.
All right. I've never thought of myself as a talent scout, but I suppose I could do that.
I suppose you're coming too, Ingram?
Of course. There's still a chance that something exciting may happen that I can write about.
It was just after midnight in Bismarck, and by now even the saloons were quiet. The
Missouri River gleamed silver in the moonlight as Angus Eversole, Clay Hawkins, Ike Peters, and Jim Dewey walked quietly down 4th Street, heading for the dimly lit jail. Looking around to make certain they weren't being watched, the four men stepped onto the porch of the jail. Eversole tried the door, but it didn't open.
Damn, it's locked.
It's supposed to be locked. It's a jail.
Yeah, but jails are supposed to lock people in, not lock them out.
Dewey took a quick glance through the window.
Hey, I got an idea. Knock on the door.
Ain't much chance of surprising him by knocking on the door.
I'm going to pretend to be drunk. Knock on the door. When the deputy opens it, tell him you want to put me in jail to keep me out of trouble.
That might work.
Peter shrugged.
May as well try it.
Eversole nodded, then he knocked loudly on the door.
Marshal! Marshal! You in there?
He knocked again. The door opened and a young man, wearing the badge of a deputy, stepped back from the open door. He was holding a double-barrel shotgun in his hands.
What do you want?
Our part here is drunk.
Oh, I ain't no more drunk than you are, you lying some bitch.
Yeah, what does that mean to me that he's drunk?
Well, you want to lock him up tonight so he don't get in no trouble.
Just take him somewhere and let him sleep it off. I don't have the authority to lock someone up.
What do you mean you don't have any authority? You're a deputy, ain't you?
I can't lock someone up just for being drunk. If I did that, the jail would be full every night.
See? I told you I weren't going to spend no night in jail.
Dewey made a drunken lurch toward the deputy.
You're a good man, deputy. Yes, sir. You're a good man.
The deputy tried to back away from him, but it was too late. Dewey grabbed his shotgun and pointed it straight up. Then he jerked it away from him.
What the hell?
Eversole brought his pistol down sharply on the deputy's head. He fell unconscious to the floor.
Billy? Billy boy, are you back there?
Yeah, I'm over here.
Hold on a second. We're getting you out of here.
Eversole got the key from a hook on the wall and opened the cell door.
I knowed you boys wasn't going to leave me here.
A wide smile spread across Billy Taylor's face. Taylor was the youngest of the group, and at first glance, most women found him good-looking. But upon a further examination, there was something in his eyes that just put them off. One woman said that he was like fine crystal, but with a flaw in its casting.
Oh, yes, sir. I knowed you boys was gonna get me out of here one way or the other.
It was not unusual for Running Elk to ride into the small town of Damaris Springs, but there was something going on today that was unusual. As he rode down Center Street, he saw several people gathered around the front of a hardware store. Curious as to what was attracting so much interest, he guided his pony over to see. There, in front of the hardware store and strapped to boards so they could be stood up, were the bodies of a man, woman, and child. All three had been scalped, and a sign posted over the top of the three bodies read, Frank, Ann, and Davy Barlow, murdered by Indians. Running Elk was mounted and behind the crowd of people, so at first no one saw him. Then a woman happened to turn and she saw him.
Oh! There's one of the savages now!
Get him! Straighten
him
up!
We did not do this terrible thing! We are Crow! We are friends with the white man!
Come on! Let's get him! Get the heathen!
Fortunately for Running Elk, none of the townspeople who gathered around the hardware store were armed. Neither were they mounted, so as they surged toward him, it was easy for Running Elk to slap his legs against the sides of his pony and gallop away. Before Running Elk could get back home to warn the others, though, Many Buffalo, an older Crow who was very friendly with the whites, decided to take a wagon into town. He was accompanied by his granddaughter, White Deer, her husband, One Feather, their two children, and Quiet Stream, One Feather's sister. Quiet Stream rode to town to sell her blankets. One Feather sat his pony and rode alongside the wagon. Many Buffalo fell out of the wagon, dead before he hit the ground. White Deer jumped down and tried to run away, but she was shot as well. Picking up the loose reins, Quiet Stream turned the wagon around, then drove away as rapidly as possible. Several white men came over the crest of a hill and began chasing them. But One Feather, who had stayed behind, was able to hold them off long enough to give Quiet Stream a head start. After running the team for at least 10 minutes at full speed, Quiet Stream looked back, and seeing no one, she slowed the team to a walk. She saw a house ahead and turned onto the property to ask for shelter.
Chill!
At the shot from the house, she lashed her horses back into a run. Back at the point of the initial attack, White Deer, shot twice, lay helpless on the ground as two of the men who had attacked him walked over to Many Buffalo and looked down at the old Indian's body. White Deer lay quiet, pretending to be dead.
Regret? Look at the old son of a bitch. You know, in his life, he's taken few white scalps.
Yeah, Davis, I believe it. I don't know as I feel all that good about killing the woman, though.
Why not? The Injuns didn't mind killing the Barlow woman and her kid.
So, what are we gonna do now?
We're gonna leave the Injuns a message.
Yeah, I reckon this will leave them a message.
No, I mean a real message. We're going to leave a note. I want the Injuns to know who done this and why.
A note?
This note. I already got it wrote. All we have to do is leave it pinned on them so the Injuns will find it.
How are we going to pin it on them?
Davis knelt down and pulled Many Buffalo's hunting knife from its sheath.
You want to see how I pin the note on?
He drove the knife through the note, pinning it to Many Buffalo's chest.
I don't reckon that note's gonna blow away.
White Deer knew that her father was already dead, but it was all she could do to keep from crying out when she saw that knife plunged into his chest.
What about the squaw?
What about her?
You just gonna leave her there?
What do you wanna do? Bury her?
No, nothing like that. I was just wondering.
Leave her. When they find her, the old man and the buck we killed, they'll know we mean business.
Yeah, if this don't teach him a lesson, nothing will.
Let's go.
White Deer continued to lie unmoving for a long time after they left, still terrified that they would come back. She waited until the sound of hoofbeats could no longer be heard before she raised her head. The first thing she saw was the pony of her husband. When she saw the pony of One Feather, she knew that if the pony was without a rider, One Feather must have been killed as well. She also knew Quiet Stream drove the wagon away with her children, giving her at least hope that they survived. White Deer managed to mount the pony and rode away. After a ride of well over an hour, she experienced a great sense of relief as she reached the house of Chris Doomy, a settler that she knew. She stopped in front of the house and stayed on the pony by great effort because she was still losing blood.
Help! Please! I have been shot! Mr. Doomy! Please help me!
The door to the house opened just a crack, and a man thrust a shotgun through the opening.
Get out of here, Indian!
Mr. Doomy! It is me, White Deer! I have been shot! I need help!
If you don't get now, you gonna get shot again! Now get!
Somehow, fear helped her overcome her dizziness, and she moved on. She passed other settlers' homes on her way back to the village. Though she knew the people living in those houses, she gave them all a wide berth. It was dark by the time White Deer returned to the village, and because Quiet Stream had already made it back safely with word of the attack, the entire village was in an uproar.
Look! There's White Deer!
High Hawk rushed up and steadied White Deer's horse.
We thought you were dead. Where is One Feather?
He is dead. So is my father. I don't know where my children are. I don't know where Quiet Stream is.
I am here, White Deer.
Your children are safe. I... thank you.
Knowing now that her children were safe, White Deer finally quit hanging on. It was two hunters from the Crow Village who found the bodies of many buffalo and one feather the next day. Constructing the travois, they brought the dead back to the village. They had found a piece of paper on Many Buffalo's body, pinned to him by his own knife.
Running Elk, come, we have need of your learning.
Yes, High Hawk.
Read this.
We killed these Injuns because they did not stay where they belonged. We will kill all Injuns who do not stay where they belong.
Now, the people became painfully aware of the situation. The paper words made it clear that the earlier murders, just like these, were not merely the isolated incident of one or two whites. It was an organized movement, designed, no doubt, to run the Indians away from their land so that the whites could look for gold anywhere they damn well wanted.
The whites are devils! We should kill them all! Mean to his horses is right! There can be no peace until the white man knows we are men and not animals to be hunted!
White Bull, do not let the heat of your heart rule the reason of your mind. Mean to his horses is Cheyenne. The Cheyenne are our ancient enemies. We are friends of the white man. Our warriors have fought at the side of the Long Knives. We have learned many things from our white brothers.
We have learned to be cowards. But I will not be a coward. I will join Mean to his horses.
I will join him as well.
Running Elk, no. You have been educated by the white men. You are the future of our people.
If the white people kill us all, we have no future. White Bull speaks for me.
All who are brave of heart come with me. We will go to Mean to his horses and ask him to lead us.
Though the saloon in Miles City didn't cater exclusively to the army, its proximity to Fort Keogh meant that soldiers made up the bulk of its customers. Today was payday for the army, and on this evening that saloon was full. One of the centerpieces of the saloon was its recent acquisition of a lithograph of Custer's last fight. Sergeant Patrick Connolly sat at a table with Sergeant Lucas Depro and several other soldiers. All asked Connolly about his role on that fateful scout, taking part in the hilltop fight with Reno and Benteen, where he fell wounded. Connolly pointed to figures in the paint.
That lad there is my friend Edward Connor, like me, Irish-born. And Patrick Downing and Charles Graham, Irish-born too. And there's himself, Captain Miles Keogh, as fine an officer as ever drew breath. Irish he was, like the others.
You were with Benteen, were you?
Aye, Depro. Though I was with Reno when we first split up. Benteen, you know, he came up to join with us.
What do you think of Benteen?
Oh, sure, no, why'd you ask? Would you be wanting me to speak unkindly of an officer who shared the dangers of hilltop fighting with myself? For I'm telling you, that'll not do.
You know he's here at Fort Keogh in command of the colored troops, don't you?
Aye, and how is it I wouldn't know? Being as I'm on the same post and have known the man for more than 10 years now.
Yeah, well, what kind of white man would let himself be stuck with a bunch of colored men?
Don't you be making a mistake now, thinking that the coloreds don't make good soldiers, Depro. They are good soldiers, the lot of them.
I've got nothing good to say about Coltrane.
I know the two of you are working together now. Just thinking I was that mayhaps the two of you'd be getting on just fine.
We ain't working together. We're in the same building. But he's supply sergeant for the 9th, I'm supply sergeant for the 6th.
But it's the same army, is it not?
Not to me it ain't. The 9th is all colored soldiers. The 6th is all white.
Sergeant Depro, 'tis Irish born I am. But since taking the oath to wear this uniform and defend the flag of the United States, I'm more American than I am Irish. Seems to me you could do the same.
Well, maybe the Irish and the colored are the same. But don't include me with you.
Hello, Sarge. Can I speak with you for a moment?
Looking up toward the speaker, Depro recognized Sam Davis. Davis had been a trooper in his platoon, but got out when his enlistment expired.
Want to join up again, do you, Davis?
No, nothing like that. This is something else.
Well, speak up.
I'd rather talk to you in private. I'll buy you a beer.
Well, being as you are a rich civilian now, I reckon I can let you buy me a beer, all right? You boys carry on without me.
Davis followed D-Pro through the crowd to a table in the far back corner where another civilian sat. When that civilian looked up toward him, D-Pro recognized Lee Regret. Like Davis, Regret had once served in D-Pro's platoon.
Now, if you're planning on telling me that Regret wants to re-enlist, you can just forget about it.
No, he don't want to enlist neither. But he's in on what I got to talk to you about.
Hello, Sarge!
Regret.
Regret, how about getting us another beer? And get one for the Sarge.
Regret nodded, then got up from the table and headed toward the bar.
Regret is your dog robber now, is he?
I know you and Regret never got along, but he's a good man.
A moment later, Regret returned with three beers and passed them around. D-Pro took a swallow, then wiped the foam from his mustache.
All right, what does he want to talk about?
Money.
Money? What about money?
I know how you can make some.
You know how I can make some money?
A lot of money.
Established in August 1876, Fort Keogh was located on the right bank of the Yellowstone River, just west of Miles City and 2 miles above the mouth of the Tongue River. Established by Colonel Nelson A. Miles by order of Brigadier General Alfred Terry, it was intended to serve as a base of supply and operations against the Sioux Indians. Construction of permanent buildings commenced in 1877. Originally called the New Post on the Yellowstone, the Cantonment on Tongue River, and then Tongue River Barracks, it was finally designated Fort Keogh on November 8, 1878, in honor of Captain Miles Keogh, 7th U.S. Cavalry, killed in the Battle of Little Bighorn on June 25, 1876. The post was one of several established during the period for the purpose of subduing the Indians of the Northern Plains and securing permanent control over them. A substantial garrison, the fort consisted of several buildings, including quarters for officers and men, barns, warehouses, and mess halls. Stationed at the fort were four troops of Buffalo soldiers, the 9th Cavalry, with their headquarters and band under Major Frederick Benteen. Here, too, were three troops of the 6th Cavalry, under Lieutenant Colonel Benjamin Whitehead. As a general rule, the officers did not frequent the trooper's saloon in Miles City. To do so would put him in close social contact with the enlisted men, a practice frowned upon. This led the officers to ply their social intercourse in the officers' open mess on the grounds of the fort. All the 9th Cavalry officers were white. Thus, in the mess at least, the officers of the 9th and the 6th commingled. Major Benteen stepped into the officers' open mess, where several of them engaged in a spirited discussion. One of them, Captain Jones, looked up as Benteen came in.
Major Benteen!
Benteen took a seat at the table with the others. Captain Jones leaned into him.
You've been fighting Indians for over 20 years now. Tell me, do you think we're about to get into another Indian war?
Benteen poured himself a glass of whiskey.
What would make you think that? That's his spirit-talking business. It was started by an Indian who was at Custer's last fight, a chief by the name of...
Mean to his horses. Yeah, he's not a chief. He's a shaman.
Well, whatever he is, a lot of Indians are listening to him. And I don't mean just the Cheyenne, either.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't worry about it. If we do get into another little skirmish, I don't expect it'll come to much. I think all the Indians are whipped now. They're tired of fighting.
A newly minted lieutenant joined in.
Excuse me, Major, but isn't that what Custer thought? I mean, from what I read and heard when I was at the academy, the Indians gave Custer, you, and the rest of the 7th a pretty good whipping.
All their beer mugs hit the table, and every man in the bar turned toward Benteen to see how he would react. Benteen said nothing. He lifted his glass to his lips and glared at the young lieutenant. He held that silent glare for a long moment. And as the moment lengthened and the silence stretched out, the lieutenant became visibly shaken.
Well, I didn't mean you got the whipping. Everyone knows that you weren't actually with Custer when he went into the battle, that you hung back and...
Lieutenant Colonel Whitehead stepped up to the table.
Lieutenant Simmons, I think you'd better quit before you get yourself in any deeper.
Yes, sir. I told Sergeant Templeton that I would look into something with him. I need to leave.
But, Lieutenant, you didn't finish your drink.
I'm not thirsty, sir.
Lieutenant Simmons skedaddled out of that club.
You're gonna have to teach me that stare sometime, Benteen.
Yes, sir, I'd be glad to.
But first, I'd be interested in knowing what you think about our current situation. I'll ask you the same question Captain Jones asked. Do you think there's gonna be another Indian war?
Do you think there will be?
I don't know. I know that Mean to His Horses has been leading some renegades on a tear. There was that massacre of the Kennedy family up in Montana Territory. Then the attack on the freight wagons.
Yes, but you said it for what it is. It's a group of renegade Cheyenne.
Not just Cheyenne. There was the Barlow family that got murdered, and those two white prospectors found shot and scalped in the Yellowstone Valley. That was down here in Wyoming, and more than likely it was Crow that did that.
How many prospectors do we have poking around out there right now?
I don't know for sure. 20 or 30, I'd say.
Yeah, with that many gold hunters out there, don't you think it is just possible that those two got into an argument with some other prospectors? They were murdered, then scalped to make it look like Indians did it?
As I understand, there were also some Indians killed. No doubt reprisals by the whites who live nearby.
At this point, I don't see a couple of white men and a few Indians getting killed being enough to get us into a war, especially with the Crow. I have put my life in the hands of the Crow many times.
Things are different now.
What's so different?
It's the spirit talking business.
Well, as long as they're talking to spirits, they aren't fighting the army.
Yes, I guess that's true. Still, one wonders. I know for a fact that General Miles is worried about it. He thinks Sitting Bull might be leading the Indians.
Sitting Bull? Are you talking about the same Sitting Bull who went into show business with Buffalo Bill Cody? That Sitting Bull?
Yes, the one who led the Sioux in the fight at Little Bighorn.
Sitting Bull remained in his teepee for the entire fight. He couldn't lead a bunch of holy rollers to Jesus.
What if we do get into a fight? Can we count on you?
What do you mean, can you count on me?
I don't mean you personally. I meant, can we count on your colored soldiers?
Don't you worry about my colored soldiers, Colonel Whitehead. They are as good as any soldiers I have ever served with.
They are as good as any you ever served with? That's quite a statement, isn't it? I mean, considering that you served with Custer in the 7th.
I will say it again. My colored soldiers are as good as any soldier I have ever served with.
After leaving Fort Yates and their rendezvous with Sitting Bull, Falcon, Cody, and Ingram proceeded farther west by rail, leaving the train at Miles City, Montana Territory. With a 3-day wait for the boat to arrive that would take them down the Tongue River to Sheridan, Wyoming Territory, Cody suggested they pay a visit to Fort Keogh. Colonel Whitehead rose from his desk as Falcon, Ingram, and Cody stepped into his office.
Now, Buffalo Bill Cody, I can't tell you how pleased we are to have you visiting us.
Thank you, Colonel. May I introduce my friends? This is Falcon McAllister, and this is Prentice Ingram.
Falcon McAllister, you were at the fight at Little Bighorn, weren't you?
Yeah. I was actually looking for a couple of lost Gatling guns, but wound up with Reno during the fight.
Ah, there's someone here you should see.
Whitehead held up his finger as if telling Falcon to wait for just a moment. Then he stepped to the door.
Mike, would you have the CO of the 9th come to my office, please?
Whitehead turned back to Cody's group.
We are a sort of forgotten post here. We don't get many guests, especially guests of your caliber. How long will you be here?
Just long enough to catch a boat down to Sheridan.
Good. That means you'll be here for 3 days at least. Have you a place to stay while you're here?
We thought we would get rooms in the hotel.
Chances are there won't even be one room available, since the boat passengers stay there until the boat leaves. And even if you could pick up a room, believe me, it's little better than sleeping in a stable. We can put you up here on the post.
Oh, we don't want to intrude.
You won't be intruding. We have enough vacant rooms in the bachelor officer's quarters to accommodate all three of you. You're welcome to them.
Well, thank you. That is very decent of you.
Oh, and tomorrow night we'll have a dance in your honor.
Oh, Colonel, now please don't go to any trouble on our part.
Trouble? Believe me, Colonel Cody, it's no trouble. It's an honor and a privilege. And I know the ladies have wanted to hold another dance. This will be the perfect opportunity. There's difficult duty here for all of us, isolated as we are, but it's particularly difficult for the ladies.
You sent for me, Colonel?
Yes, Major. You have an old friend here I thought you might like to see. Colonel Falcon McAllister.
Benteen looked over at Falcon.
I thought your colonel's rank was temporary from the state of Colorado.
It was then. Now I have another temporary rank, this time from the U.S. Army. I see you've been promoted to major.
What are you doing here?
We're just passing through.
But they're going to be here for a few days. I've asked them to stay in the BOQ. The ladies will be planning a dance for tomorrow night, and they'll be our special guests.
Well, I'm sure the ladies will appreciate that. Colonel, if you'll excuse me, I must get back to my men. I'll see you tomorrow night.
The dance the next evening took place at the Sutler's store. For the most part, Falcon sat at a table with Colonel Whitehead, who graciously allowed his wife to dance with all the soldiers, officers, and NCOs who didn't have wives of their own.
Did Sitting Bull shed any light on this spirit-talking business?
Nothing that we didn't already know.
Mean to his horses is bad news. I suppose you heard about the Kennedy massacre.
Yeah.
Roman nose, crazy horse, tall bull. None of them were as brutal to civilians as Mean to his horses has been.
There is a difference, though. They were all part of their established tribes, and it was during a time of war between the Indians and the white man. Mean to his horses is a renegade, pure and simple.
That's true. There's another big difference.
What's that?
Roman Nose, Crazy Horse, and Tall Bull are all dead. This son of a bitch is still alive.
Benteen was a late arrival at the dance, and when he did arrive, Whitehead excused himself.
Gentlemen, if you'll excuse me, I need to dance with my wife or I'm going to hear about it.
Mrs. Benteen isn't here?
At the moment, she's in St. Louis.
The two men sat in silence for a moment.
Well, aren't you going to join the chorus?
What chorus would that be?
The chorus that says I betrayed Custer. That if I'd brought my battalion up quickly enough, I could have joined him and the outcome would have been different. Benteen, Big Sioux Village, come quick, bring packs. P.S., bring packs. Is there one person in America now who's not aware of that last message from Custer?
Major, I was with Reno that day. If you'd not come to Reno's aid, I might not be here today.
Benteen was silent for a long moment. Finally, he shook his head.
Thank you for that, Colonel. It's good to hear something from someone who was there and who knows all the details and nuances. Sometimes I think I'm going to be like Judas Iscariot, damned for all eternity because I betrayed Custer. I didn't like the man, and I made no excuses about that, but damn it, I did what I thought was best that day. Custer had the largest battalion. He had competent officers. I had no idea that he was in such dire circumstances. Reno was the most inexperienced officer in the entire regiment, and he only had half as many men with him as Custer had. And given the choice, I thought Reno and his men were in more danger than Custer.
You made the choice of a battlefield commander. There are very few men who have ever actually been in that position, which means there are very few who have the slightest idea of what it's like to make life or death decisions in the blink of an eye.
Poor Marcus. He's fallen on very hard times, you know. He was cashiered from the Army for public drunkenness and lewd behavior, but I've heard from some of the officers who served with him that that was all a put-up deal.
Where is he now?
He's in Washington, D.C., working as a very low-level clerk. He tried to get a book published about his role in the battle, but it was rejected. I sent him some money a few months ago. I hated to embarrass him that way, but I knew that he was just barely hanging on.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Godfrey, Larned, Varnum, they all abandoned him.
Colonel Whitehead returned to the table, visibly sweating.
Oh, I'll tell you, I don't know how the ladies are able to dance every dance as they do. One dance is enough to wear me out. Fred, you must put your name on some of the dance cards. I'm sure the ladies would be happy to dance with you.
Now, thank you, Colonel, but I'll defer to the younger officers and NCOs. Besides, as none of my men are here, I feel a little out of place.
Surely, Major, you aren't suggesting that the dance be open to the colored soldiers.
No, Colonel, not at all. I just made the comment that as they cannot participate in the dance, I, as their commanding officer, feel that I should not be here as well.
Well, I think that's foolish, but it's certainly your right to make such a decision. The Sergeant Major's wife is headed straight for me with that look in her eyes. I guess I must dance with her.
Did you hear about Tom Weir?
I know that he died.
You remember that he wanted to go help Custer, but got no farther than the very next hill? By the time he got there, it's too late. It's obvious now that Custer and all his men were already dead, and the Indians were coming hard toward Weir. He barely made it back in time.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Well, Weir resigned his commission almost immediately after we got back to Fort Lincoln. I tried to talk him out of it, but he wouldn't listen. He went back to New York City. I got a letter from one of his friends there who said that he was afraid Tom was losing his mind. He wouldn't eat, he wouldn't leave his apartment. All he did was lay around and drink whiskey. Toward the end, he wouldn't even talk to anyone, nor would he get out of bed. His drinking got worse and worse until one day he laid down to take a nap and he never woke up. All that in less than 6 months. The young, aggressive, courageous officer who stormed the hill in his attempt to go to the rescue of his commanding officer was, within 6 months of that date, a helpless, drunk, despondent invalid, dying in bed in a fifth-floor walk-up in New York.